Rise and shine, football fans. Start your day the right way with Morning Footy, a podcast that covers every aspect of the global game, headlines, match previews, analysis, interviews, culture, fashion, and plenty of banter. Join as we track the thrills and spills of Europe's biggest title races, the business end of the Champions League season, a summer packed with international competitions, MLS, NWSL, and much more. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
It's the Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert.
My guest tonight has spent four decades entertaining us. His radio show is exclusively on Sirius XM, and his new book is called Howard Stern Comes Again. Please welcome the king of all media, Howard Stern.
How about another song?
No, so we'll get you on the...
Another song?
Three acts. We'll do every act.
Give me a nice beat, and I'll sing.
Yes.
I'll sing. And now I'd like to do a song. It's a very good book. I'm here to promote my book. I'm gonna talk to Stephen. It's gonna be great. I got the band. I interviewed Madonna, Paul McCartney. I interviewed Stephen, Jimmy, and the other Jimmy, and Ellen DeGeneres, Rosie O'Donnell. Howard Stern comes again. Howard Stern comes again. Howard Stern comes again. That's it. Beautiful.
There it is.
I don't do that a lot. What a band. That band is like a Ferrari.
Unbelievable.
You got it? Yes. Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for, Howard.
No, I got to leave. The band is like a Ferrari. You got to take it out and drive it.
Oh, yeah. You got to rev it up.
I see you come out here. You run out. You do your thing. Sometimes I think you're going to have a heart attack. You're way excited. But I can see the band gets you into it, and you get all
you can't
charged
fight
up.
You
How
can't
is everybody? It. Okay? Stephen.
Welcome to The Late Show, Howard Stern.
Thank you. One thing you have not changed since David Letterman was here, it is freezing in here. Am I right?
This is comedy weather.
I need a throw blanket or something. It's unbelievable. Why so cold?
Thank you, by the way. Thank you for stopping by on your way to the funeral.
I know. Well, I thought I looked good.
Yeah, you do. You do look good.
You know what happened to me?
Lifelike. I would describe you as lifelike.
You know what happened to me?
You look like you're just sleeping.
I did 4 years on America's Got Talent.
I was on it once.
Right. And I was like, you know, I should get a new wardrobe. I'm going to be on television, on a network television show. I was all excited. So I went out.
Yeah.
And bought a bunch of suits.
Yeah.
I got them from John Varvatos. You know John Varvatos? Very, very popular. You don't know him?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I barely know him. Yeah. But he's fantastic. And I bought these suits, and now they sit in my closet. So I left America's Got Talent because it was basically silly. I was judging singers. I don't sing.
No.
You know, I mean,
what am I doing? You have ears.
Oh, I would go out there. I would go, oh, you're terrible. You can't sing this and that and the other thing. And I was like, oh, well, who cares if I ruin their career? I'm interesting. But, I mean, it was fun for a while, but, you know, you get it.
But you write about that. You write about that in the book. In the book.
Yes, that
Howard
book.
Howard Stern comes again.
Stephen.
You write about being on, what's it called, America's Got...
Talent.
America's
I did
got
that.
Talent.
Turns out America didn't have that much talent.
Yes.
But
that you were like kind of as a way for you to be Santa Claus, to be a nice guy.
Yeah, it's a very funny thing what happened to me on America's Got Talent. Here I was fart man. People were scared of me. Children would run from me when I was in the room.
Sure.
And then I go on this family-friendly show, which I thought would be quite shocking. If I went on a show and I was like this teddy bear, you know what I mean? So the weirdest thing happens. I start going to restaurants with my wife the first year America's Got Talent is on. Mm-hmm. And suddenly people are coming up, can my kid sit on your lap? Like I'm Santa Claus.
Wow.
And I go, what bizarre world are we living in? Do these parents know what I do for a living?
Wow. And are they blind? Because you do not look like you look like a disturbed uncle.
I do. I scare children, Steve.
Yes, I know.
But all of a sudden, I was sort of family friendly, and I actually kind of got off on it, and it was fun to do for a couple of years. But that's enough, you know what I mean? I went back to being a monster, and I'm fine. All right, anyway, never mind. Let's talk about my book.
Let's talk about your book. Okay, a collection of your favorite interviews. As I said, mine's included because you wanted to sell a few.
Right.
I said last night, and I mean this sincerely. You're maybe the best interviewer I've ever been the honor of
Thank
being
you.
Interviewed by.
Thank you.
You and Terry Gross. Terry's really good.
Yeah.
Terry Gross. What's the key to a good interview? What do you think the key is? It agenda or is it improvising with the guests?
I think there's three key things, and this is why I wrote the book. And the book is quite serious because people had said to me for years, "Hey, you're a good interviewer," and I was proud of that. And for the first time in my career, I said, "You know, maybe it's time to put out a collection of these interviews. I think they're fun, they're interesting, and you learn something from everybody, as I did from you." But, you know,
and it's easy because it's already been written.
Well, yeah, in a way. But I also I didn't want to just print interviews. I also wrote something about my own evolution in life and the conclusions I came to, because people who knew me on terrestrial radio knew me. In a way, I was kind of a victim of the ratings. And in my mind, you had to keep things moving fast.
What do you mean victim?
It is so competitive in the morning that for me to have stepped back and even had a guest like you on and get into a discussion that would have gone on for an hour and a half like we do,
right.
I don't think it's conducive. My feeling was I needed to constantly pump the ratings, do something different every 5 minutes, and the idea of having a long-form interview on terrestrial radio was impossible.
That is one thing I'll say, is that an hour and a half with you is incredibly enjoyable because your research is extraordinary. You ask me questions that no one, I mean, I've been interviewed by a million people. You ask me questions, almost every one of your questions was different than any other question I've gotten before.
Well, in all seriousness, the reason I didn't know you personally at all when you came in the first time, and we got into a rather heavy discussion. And we spoke, and I didn't know you in this way. I didn't, you know, we know you as a comedian, but to sit there and have a very serious discussion. And you and I shared a moment in that interview that I'm very proud of. You were talking about the death of your father in the family and your siblings, and it was heavy. And I said to you, what was it like to have a sad, depressed mother? And did you find it was a burden to have to cheer your mother up? And you kind of stopped, and you said, how do you know how to ask this? And I said, because my mother was depressed. She was very sad. She lost her mother when she was 9. She had really grown up in difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I felt, as a kid growing up, there was no greater joy in my life than to sit with my mother, and it gives me chills to think about it, and entertain her. And the way I would entertain her is I would do impressions of all the mothers and fathers in my neighborhood for her and all these conversations that I heard in her house.
Uh-huh. Yeah, sure.
But I also realized when I went into therapy that this was a tremendous burden. I only wanted to make my mother laugh.
And that's sort of like why you were doing your show?
I think the reason I got into radio is my father was not a very emotional guy, or we didn't share a lot of personal moments together. But my father was a radio engineer and later became a recording engineer. And when he worked in that business, he was the guy who would set up the microphones and record some of the greatest voice people, Raymond Burr. He would do commercials. He would do Tennessee Tuxedo cartoons with Larry Storch, who is a great comedian, Don Adams. And the way my father would look at the radio announcers and the way he would look at these performers, I said, oh, that's how you get my father's attention. When my father would listen to the radio, he'd listen to this guy, Bob Grant, who was on in New York. My father would, shh, be quiet, Bob Grant is talking. And I think I became transfixed that this would be the way I could really communicate with my father, by getting on the radio. And none of this was conscious.
But did it work? Did you actually communicate with your father that way?
Well,
first of all, are your parents still with us?
My parents are. My father's 96 and my mother's 91. Yeah. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I mean,
congratulations on your genes, and also to be at this stage of your life, both, you know, both physically, your career, and sort of psychologically, that you can express that to them now.
Well, I
said, you can have that sort of closure with them.
I said to my mother the other night, I said, you know, I kind of feel like Prince Charles. When am I going to get the throne? You've been alive so long, you know? We kid around like that.
Sure, sure, sure.
And she said, listen, I've got to stick around to keep an eye on you and what you're doing. And, you know, I get a real kick out of her. Yeah, they're still around. And, you know, I talk about that in the book. It's almost like I had magical thinking even when it came to my health. I would sit there and think, my parents have this glorious old age, therefore I'm entitled to live forever too, because shouldn't I genetically have their genes and I will live to 96 and 91?
And you had a scare.
I wrote in the book, I got walloped. They came to me and said, 95% chance you have kidney cancer. And I freaked out. This can't be. This doesn't happen to me. Number one, I'm famous.
Yeah.
Number two, I'm successful.
Now, this is news to some people because, unlike most of your life, you didn't talk about this on air. Why is this the one thing? Because you've been very open about your life.
Well, because, by the way, it's so cold in here, my nose is running. So I'm going to pick my nose for just a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, the reason I kept that off the air, and maybe you would understand this. So the doctor tells me, you probably have kidney cancer, you have to go in for an operation. And I, as a radio performer, and I'm very close with my audience, I take phone calls, we have this direct communication. And I became really nervous that if I got on the air and revealed this, people would start calling me up and going, listen, I had a brother who went through this. Unfortunately, he died, and you know, they told him, don't worry, it's not gonna be a big deal. And people fill your heads with all kinds of misinformation. And I'm a neurotic. And I believe whatever anyone says.
I thought you were going to say, I didn't want the audience to worry about me, but no.
No, who cares about
that? You didn't want to worry about you.
I didn't want, because I'm too paranoid. The other thing comes from a performance standpoint. If you tell the audience you're going through something, I was afraid they'd say, oh, he had a crummy show today. It's because he's sick, he's worried, this and that. So I didn't even want that to interfere in the whole performance.
And if you had a crummy show, you wanted them to just think, that's
Howard. That I'm just crummy.
That's Howard, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, people say, yeah, you know, I noticed since he's sick, he's not doing the same thing.
Right,
he doesn't have
the
energy.
Right, right.
So, you know, I didn't want to go through that. And thirdly, I don't even think I had I couldn't face the fact that I might have cancer. Now, it turned out, thank God, it was a cyst, and nothing to do with cancer. But I went through the whole surgery and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I never mentioned on the air that I went through this surgery, and I missed a day of work, and it turned into kind of a big thing because I never miss work. But, you know, look.
But then you still had the psychological sort of shift of facing your own mortality, I assume?
Yeah, it was terrible. I just, it sounds weird to say, but I just didn't picture myself having a health issue ever. And I'm not prepared for that kind of thing, I realized. And, you know, circling back to what you said, what makes a good interviewer and why did I write this book? You know, there's a certain thing that happened for me. I went into psychotherapy, which I used to kind of laugh at and think, oh, I have it all together. I know what's going on. And I equated my success with that. I'm fine. Everything's good. But I had gone through a divorce. I have three young daughters at the time. And I pushed myself into the psychotherapy. And I got to tell you, I am a poster boy now, especially you, sir, you need it. I am the poster boy for psychotherapy. I think it's terrific, and I got in touch with a lot of things about myself I didn't like, and it was quite a journey. But what happened for me was that when I sat in this psychiatrist's office for the first time in my life, here was another adult, a man, listening to me and actually treating me seriously. The first time I went in to see this guy, I just, from what I saw on TV, you go in and you talk about your parents. So I start doing elaborate routines for the psychiatrist.
Like you're entertaining him.
Like I'm doing a radio show.
Sure.
I said, oh, my mother. She's like, listen, you are doing too much. We only tell you to do one thing a day.
That's right. Your mother and I do one thing a day.
And let me tell you, you do. I see you running around and you're on TV and radio. What is you doing it for? It's too much and what's it all mean? And you're gonna get yourself sick. And what's with all this running around? So I'm telling the psychiatrist and he's sitting there like I'm bombing in the room and he's not laughing. And I go, you know, I get paid to do this stuff.
Sure.
He said to me for the first time, I don't find any of this funny. I go, great. But he said, in fact, I see that it's rather sad. And I was like, really? What do you mean? I didn't think of myself that way. Mm-hmm. And then we got into some real discussion. And I craved it. I never had that kind of attention. I never had that kind of focus.
Are you ever tempted? Do you ever find yourself sort of, as a performer, slipping into performance mode when you're in therapy?
All the
time. You have to check yourself, like, oh, no, this is not, I'm not here to perform for this person. I'm here to be selfish for myself.
He's very astute, the psychiatrist. He'll say to me, I don't sense you're in the room right now. I get a lot of that because I do slip into a performance. Sure. So, you know, I feel bad for him. I think I'm a very difficult person to have in psychoanalysis.
Right, right.
Because, I mean, I do slip in and out, and I'm testing the therapist all the time.
What do you mean?
I'll sit there and I will purposely slip into a story or something to see if he catches it. And he does every time. He knows. And
you're monologuing.
I'm monologuing.
Like a supervillain.
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah.
But so what happened for me is I said, you know, wouldn't it be interesting? Now I'm on satellite radio. I can do whatever I want. People are expecting me now to be more sexual than I've ever been. To sit there and I don't know what I make, like maybe hang people upside down from the rafters naked or
yes.
Whatever it was.
You actually had some fairly extreme stuff when you first went over.
Very extreme, but yeah. To me that was outrageous for terrestrial radio. Religious groups were against me. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, wanted to keep fining our radio stations, and that was punk rock. That was revolutionary.
Sure, sure.
That was insane.
Right. You need the friction.
Yeah, but if you get to satellite. What is it you want to do with this medium? And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if I could get some really accomplished people, fabulous people, to come in and sit down and have a real conversation with me? I've been very honest over the years with my audience. You know, everything from penis size to sexual habits to gas, you know, I mean, whatever it is I talk about.
And the wouldn't
big it be, the big three, you know, you do the same thing. Who are you having on tomorrow night?
Kamala Harris.
You gotta hit the fart stuff. You gotta hit the, you know.
I'm not gonna ask her how big her penis is, Howard.
She's got a big penis.
I'm not gonna do it.
I certainly think she has a bigger one than me. But, you know, I have to tell you that sitting there
uh-huh.
with guests
yeah.
and actually having some real conversation has been the most rewarding part of my career. And getting accolades for it and having this book, this is why I'm out promoting it so much.
What about your history of making people feel awkward? Of like, because you have this, like, Howard Stern will ask anybody anything Howard Stern wants.
That's
right.
Do
you still do that with the guest, or where do you balance between having some sort of sympathy or empathy for the guest? How far do you push people into an awkward position? Because I was a little hesitant when I'm on your show. I'm like, where is he going to push me? Here. So I was like, well, I'll go with whatever he has. But you didn't, actually. You dug.
Right.
But it was all things that ultimately I enjoyed talking about with you.
Yeah, you know, my attitude when I first got on the radio, and because I said I was so worried about the ratings, I was number one in all these markets. Mm-hmm. I had 20-something million people listening every morning.
Right.
And I didn't think there was time, again, for any real conversation. So when a guest would walk in, I write about this in the book, like, I say one of my big regrets, people like Gilda Radner or Robin Williams in particular. I sat there and I was like, hey, Robin Williams, I heard you married your nanny, you know. And the guy was like in shock. Like, what do you mean? Like, hey, I don't think of my wife as the nanny. And he was very insulted. Mm-hmm. Gilda Radner went running out of my studio, literally went running out of
what
my studio.
What did you want?
I forget exactly what I said, but she didn't trust me. I was being too outrageous, too in her face. And it was scary to this, you know, this accomplished actress and comedian. I came on like a bull in a china shop, and it was wrong to do because it didn't lead to anything real. It didn't lead to good conversation. And I say in the book, one of my biggest regrets is that I'm a huge fan of Robin Williams. And I wasn't being generous to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't being a fan. I love David Letterman, and yet I would make fun of David Letterman and his ratings and this and that and the other thing.
Uh-huh.
It's because I just was not open to allowing anyone else to have ratings.
But did you ever apologize to these people? Like, once you came to this realization, because that's a tough thing to do.
I called several people and apologized. And Rosie O'Donnell...
Did they take it?
Some did, some didn't. There was a famous comedian I called. He said, you know what, Howard, you hurt me too much. I'm glad you called me, great, but I want nothing to do with you. And I said, I absolutely understand, but I just wanted to let you know I feel badly about the way things went. And he said, okay, and that was it. Now, other people, like Rosie O'Donnell, who I was really vicious to, and I describe in the book, my viciousness had nothing to do with any reality. It was almost like sibling rivalry. Everyone in show business was my enemy, and I was going to have every single person listening to me. If you had ratings, you were my enemy.
We talked about this when I was on, and you said, oh, come on, you want a war. You want a war, and I said, I don't. And she goes, come on, I always wanted it. And I said, did that make you happy? And you said, no.
No, it didn't.
And I said, why are you pouring the poison in my ear?
Well, by the way, you're right. And by the way, Stephen, ultimately... yeah. I don't know if I believe you, but... No, Stephen ultimately proved it to me. You got to hear this one. This is great.
They don't actually have to hear this one. I got another question for you.
Oh, what? Why not? No, let me hear. No, they need to hear this. You want to hear this?
Yeah!
No, wait a second. Let me talk about this. You told me not to say this, but...
I specifically said don't tell the story.
All right, I won't tell the story then.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I'm not going to tell it.
No, go ahead. They're going to be mad at me now. Don't tell the story.
I'm not going to tell it.
Okay, good.
Yeah. You're the bad guy, not me.
So.
I can do another song if you want.
What?
I can do another song if you want.
Now, trashing Rosie was something you had in common with Donald Trump.
Yeah, well.
Okay. How many times did you have Donald Trump on?
I too many to count. Donald Trump appears 11 times in my book, and it's a fascinating little ride through the book. Because I would have Donald Trump on, and I say it in the book, he was maybe one of the best top five guests of all time. And why? He was wild. I thought I was wild. He would come on. He would start assigning numbers to women and evaluating them. I'm like, is this guy for real? What is he doing?
Like rating them, 1 through 10.
One through 10. I went, yes. Yeah. But I'm like, who does that? You know, it's pretty wild. Right. So anyway... I'm going home.
But in your mind, a great guest.
No, a great guest because he would say anything that came into his mind. He was completely unfiltered. He was talking about his daughter was the most attractive woman he ever met and how much he thought she was hot. What's with this crowd? What are you guys on? And give me some of it. But I mean, it was wild every time. In the book, you'll read about he gets into an argument with the Daily News gossip columnist, A.J. Benzer. They're fighting over a woman that they both had sex with on the air. I mean, it's crazy stuff. So this guy, easy. So,
When's the last time you spoke to him?
This is such a long saga with Donald. He was calling me all through the campaign. I don't mean on the air, off the air.
For advice?
I think he wanted to touch base. He wanted my endorsement. And as I describe in the book, I'm a very big Hillary Clinton supporter. I liked Hillary Clinton very much. And, so Donald said, would you please come to the Republican convention and speak on my behalf? And I went, oh, my God. You know, it's a weird thing because here a guy is asking you, who asks me to do something like that? And it's very nice. But I had to find a way to say, look, I can't do this. He knows I'm a Hillary Clinton supporter.
Yeah.
And I
Before firmly, he calls you, he knows.
Yeah, and I firmly believed that Donald did not want to run for president. I don't think it was serious. I don't think he wanted to be the president. I knew him. He had a great life at Mar-a-Lago. He was running around town. He played golf. He had a good time. And I remember, and I say this, the first time he said, I might run for president, he put out his first book. And I know some of the people involved in this. And they said, pretend like you're running for president and you'll sell a lot of books. And he did it and it worked. Second book he put out, it was again like 4 years later. He said, I might run for president. And again, he said, I'm selling books and it helps sell books.
Yeah.
So what happened this time? He's on The Apprentice. The ratings were going down. And NBC was balking at giving him a raise. So what did he say? I'll run for president. I'll get a lot of press. And I really believe that Donald, this was a gimmick to get NBC to raise up his salary and to keep The Apprentice on.
Well,
and I would bet the farm on that. If he, you know, if he.
With Donald Trump, I have found, following the cat, if you'll pardon the expression, for the last few years, is that everything you think is happening is exactly what's happening.
Right.
He is so shallow, you could not get your ankles wet in him.
Well, you know what the funny thing is? The funny thing is that I for a little while I said, wait a second, if I do endorse Donald and I go all in, you know, I sell out my complete beliefs and everything else, I could potentially be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Or
not bad.
Or
I trade a couple for you, Howard.
Right.
I would trade a couple for
you. Or the head of the FCC, which plagued me my entire career.
That's not bad.
Or at the very least, I could see that place they call Camp David, which they hide from the American public. And I believe if we saw it, there'd be a revolt in this country. Because I think that place must be tricked out. And when you go there, you're treated like a king. And the president of the United States shouldn't be going to a place called Camp David. He should be in the White House working. So that's what I want to see. I want to see Camp David. I want it liberated.
Would you want to interview Trump now? And if you did, what would you ask him?
First of all, if I interviewed Trump now, I think it would have to be contentious because it becomes a political interview. I enjoyed the old Trump. So I'm waiting for him to get out of office and then I'll interview him. Because, again, politically, you know, with abortion, which I think this whole thing's going about because of who's sitting on the Supreme Court. We had that argument already. They got to stop. Mm-hmm. We have too many unwanted children. I don't know what the heck is going on with all of that, but I'm very concerned with who's going on the Supreme Court and et cetera. And the chaos that's going on internationally, I am so confused by what's going on that I don't think the interview would be something of value because it would just be me kind of erupting. I don't know. But would I interview him? Yes, of course I would. But he has not offered to come on my show since he became, you know, the nominee.
I bet he wants to.
I think
he always sounded like he was having a good time on your show.
Yeah, and I think people generally do have a good time on the show now, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it would be a different dynamic.
I understand that Hillary Clinton was like your white whale. You tried to get her to come on in 2016. You were supporting her. You tried to get her to come on. What was that process like? Was it her or was it her people keeping her from coming on?
I had a feeling that, you know, in the same way I described people like Lady Gaga or Sia or... I have some hardcore dudes in my audience, even in the case of Rosie O'Donnell. They're like, I don't like her. Basically, because she's a woman or whatever it is, they don't like her.
Never understood that.
Right. But Lady Gaga's a top 40 artist, and I don't like her, and I don't like her. And amazingly, with some of these interviews, and I have great pride in this, that after a person leaves, they go, oh, I get her now. I understand her. Because I think their humanity comes out and they go, you know what, I have something in common with this person.
Do you think it would have made a difference if she'd come on your show?
Hillary?
Yes.
I do. And that's why
How are your ratings in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan?
Okay, I'll give you my
less
theory.
Than 1%, he won by less than 1%.
Okay, I'll give you my theory on this. I thought that if I did an interview with Hillary, that she would reach a new audience. Maybe a lot of people, and as we say, when we look at the Electoral College, what are we talking about, 70,000 votes or something like that? Mm-hmm. And so if it's 70,000 votes, and in those states I am popular, particularly Pennsylvania, for example. So we have 33 million subscribers on Sirius. We anticipate at least two people in each household listening, 66 million people, maybe 60% of that audience is mine. What if Hillary had come on? And forget politics for a second, but what if we could have talked about her humanity, why she got into public service? Here's a woman who's dedicated her whole life to public service. What was her life like as a little girl growing up? What was her romance with Bill Clinton? What was she thinking when she was Secretary of State? What was she thinking when she was the First Lady? Was she saying to herself, I wish I could be president, or was she satisfied with that? There's a million questions I would have had for her that I think would have humanized her. And I made, it's kind of a fascinating story. I went out on an all-out campaign to get Hillary to come on the show because I think it could have made a difference.
Did they tell you why she wouldn't come on?
No, and I knew a lot of big higher-ups who had direct contact with her, but I believe she just got tight. She felt, hey, I think this is in the bag. I don't risk it. And I want to say to anybody who now is running as a Democrat, Donald Trump, I saw it on my show, he knows how to communicate with people. And, you know, you can mock him, you can say all the goofy stuff you want to say about the guy, but when he would come on my show, he knew how to connect. Not with the whole audience of the country, but of some people. And I think he used my show in a very effective way. And I think whoever is the Democratic nominee should consider going on Fox News for sure, as Mayor Pete
did. Who of the 24, 24 Democrats who are nominated, who would you be excited to have on?
Oh, gee, I don't know. That's
Joe Biden.
Sure, why not? Because Joe Biden's had a fascinating life.
Sure.
And I think it would be interesting.
Bernie.
I mean, Bernie Sanders, for sure. You know, Bernie Sanders is probably my biggest hero for one reason, and this is very self-serving. When the FCC was attacking me, and they were attempting to take me off the air, and in a big way, it was almost like racketeering. They kept fining our stations. They kept keeping us from buying other radio stations. Bernie Sanders got up in the Senate and said, I think what you're doing to Howard Stern is wrong. I believe in freedom of speech. And I want to go on record as saying you got to stop it. And it was pretty damn impressive. And I'll tell you, I was under siege at that point. I really was. And I thought it might be the end of my career.
What year are we talking about here?
Oh, geez. I don't even remember when he did it. I would have
1963?
No. A little later than that. Probably in the 90s. Yeah.
Now,
in the 90s.
King of all media, Howard Stern, king of all media, all, you know, books, television, radio, films. Why do you need to be the king of all media? What is driving you? Because there's one thing about, like you say, like perhaps pleasing your mother.
Right.
But you don't have to be the king of all media to please your mother.
You want a very, a very serious answer on that?
You've been giving me a lot of serious answers.
All right.
I really want to know, what is the voice in your head that makes you want that?
I think, now I'm going to get heavy here for a minute, but I think as a kid growing up, I was very isolated and very lonely and very starved for attention. And I would do a lot of things to get attention. And, you know, the world of adults and getting them to be interested in me, particularly my mother and father, I think it was a very difficult thing for me. And so, you know, growing up and then finally getting on the radio, I think... And this is it. There was one point we had one out of every four cars on the Long Island Expressway in New York listening to me. Mm-hmm. And I would go home depressed thinking, why are the other three not listening to me? And when I say depressed, I mean it. It wasn't enough for me. It's like I wanted to just have every listener and everybody's focus on me. And I will warn you, as I do in this book, that is a dangerous way to live. A, it can't be accomplished as much as I wanted to do that. But part of psychotherapy was growing up and saying, you know what, I've got to share the audience with you, Stephen Colbert. And
thank you, Howard.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
You bet.
The audience. Howard Stern Comes Again is available now. It's Howard Stern, everybody.
This has been The Late Show Poncho with Stephen Colbert. We'll be dropping classic bits and celebrity interviews 7 days a week while the show's away on summer break. The Late Show will be back on September 6th with all new episodes. If you're enjoying The Late Show Poncho, leave us a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. For more exclusive Late Show content, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and subscribe to The Late Show on YouTube.